Here we are back again. Welcome and thank you for tuning in today to another edition of Red Eyes Radio. We do independent investigations into claims and theories. We do analysis and we have conversations with researchers on many, many different topics. I'm Henrik from Sweden. We come to you three times per week. RedEyesCreations.com is our website where you can catch many more programs, follow along in our news, see our videos and more. For the full broadcast and archives, all the way back to the start, RedEyesMembers.com is the website. We have with us today from Sweden, Gurje Börjesson, to talk about the strange death of Annie Börjesson, her daughter, whom she believed was murdered in Scotland for, at this point, unknown reasons. We are going to cover as much as we can here in the beginning of this story, but then after our interview with Gurje, we are going to talk with Tom Minogue, who has been working over in Scotland to get this case opened up, lobbying Parliament there, since there's been a tremendous amount of secrecy around this case. And also keep in mind that this happened 8 years ago now, but Gurje has been investigating the case ever since, not being satisfied with the suicide stamp that the Scottish authorities attributed to this case. As the program goes on, I think this will become increasingly clear, and the connections lead down some strange places, including the trail of CIA rendition flights at Prestwick Airport in Scotland, and this might actually just be a case of mistaken identity. Hi, Gurje. Thank you for coming on the program with us. It's very nice to have you here. Of course, it's under sad circumstances, but nonetheless, thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much for wanting to take my daughter's case up in your program. I appreciate that.
Well, you bet. I mean, we hope that we can, of course, manage to shed some light on this particular case and pique some people's interest, hopefully then, in Scotland, as there seems to be some strange circumstances, as you know, in regards to cover up and whatnot, and we'll get into that later. But I mean, to begin here, then, Gurje, why don't you just tell us about Annie? What happened to her? How this case have developed in the, well, it's 8 years now have actually gone by. But I know that there are a lot of details to this story. But please feel free to take as much time as you feel is pertinent, so that our audience can get a good picture of what happened to Annie.
My daughter, as I suppose the audience is aware of, was a Swedish girl, and she lived here in Sweden with us, her family, and she had a, well, I don't know how to put it, she wanted to see something more in her life than just Sweden, you know. She had a nice job here, and she had a lot of friends and so on, but she still wanted to see something more in her life. So she went for a short trip to Scotland and liked it very much. She just stayed for a week or so. That was in 2004 then. Then she liked it so much, she decided she wanted to go back and attend a school in Edinburgh to improve her English. She spoke very good English, but she wanted to improve it, and that was a good opportunity to go there. So she went there in the autumn of 2004. And had a Cambridge exam at Aspect Language School in Edinburgh, and she still liked Edinburgh very much. She made a lot of friends, and she decided to go back again. And back home in Sweden, after Christmas, she applied for a scholarship, and she got that. And she got she did her practice at the Scottish Whiskey Heritage Centre. It's now renamed to the Scottish Experience. And she stayed there from February 2005 until August 2005. And she was very fond of Scotland and liked to be there made yet some friends, and she wanted to go back again. So in the autumn October 25, then she went back for the third time to stay.
Right.
And then she was going to just look for a nice job to see if she could find something that appealed to her. And if not, she would come home and work in our family business or find something else. So all these, and so she stayed there all the time. She stayed there at a place with apartments. It was called the Linton Court Apartments. And she stayed there. At every stay, she stayed there. And, well, she liked the place where she stayed. So that's why she always lived at the same place every time she went there. So the last time she went to Edinburgh then, that was October 25, 2005. And then December 4, 2005, that was the date when she was found dead on the shore in Prestwick. She lived in Edinburgh, but still she was found dead about 80 miles away from there, nearby the airport in Prestwick, from where she always went, returned to Sweden. At the time, the Ryanair, who was flying between Scotland and Sweden, they had not started flying from Edinburgh at that time. So
right.
If you wanted to go to Scotland, you went to Prestwick. And from there, you went by train or bus to Edinburgh. So she always went home from Scotland through Prestwick and the other way around. And when she went there, she went to Prestwick from Sweden.
Right. Now, yeah, please just carry on the story. Of course, there's much more to it than that. But so everything seemingly at first was fine and regular, right? Nothing had been, as far as you're concerned, kind of anomalous in when she's spoken to you or your family?
No, she was very fine with going there. And like I said, she likes Scotland very much and the Scottish people. And she liked the jobs she had. She liked the school she went to. And she made a lot of friends, and everything seemed very, very, very nice to her. So there was nothing strange about her stay there. She called home once in a while, and she was very pleased with being there most of the time. Of course, there were occasions when she. When something special had happened or so, but most of the time she was very comfortable living there.
Right.
Yes. Except for the last days in her life, we could see then, we understood that something had happened to her because she seemed very upset when she called home. So we know, and by looking back at her time in Edinburgh, since myself and Annie's very best friend Maria here in Sweden, we have been investigating her. We have put a schedule over her last moments and the last time she spent in Edinburgh, and we can see that something happened at least during the last week
right.
Of her life. Yeah.
So, and there is a phone call as well sometime early in December then 2005 back to you guys, back to the family where she had a little bit of a different behavior, correct?
Yeah, it was. She actually called several times, and some of the calls we missed. Some were made late at night, and she called, for instance, her brother, and he missed them because he had just gone to bed. So there were several calls, and Friday the 2nd, that she was found dead, the 4th in the morning. Friday the 2nd, I called her back because my husband told me that he felt that something was wrong. So I called Annie up, and at the time she had she was visiting the Whiskey Heritage Center for, where she did not work any longer, because at this third stay she was just looking for a nice job, as you know. So, but she, anyway, when I called her then, she was visiting the Whiskey Center again, and she was sitting talking with a Norwegian girl that she became friends with, and exactly when I called, she was sitting there talking to her. So I was calling on her cell phone, and since that's rather expensive to call to send cell phone abroad, I kept it very short, and I called her, and I said, well, how is it, Annie? Is there a problem? Because your father and brother has said that there is something not all right with you. Mm. And she said, well, I'm sitting here with this former colleague, so I can't talk right now, she said. And she said, you have to respect this, but I have to take care of this myself, she said.
Mm.
And I got rather surprised, because the words respect this, it felt a little awkward. She never had used that to me, that expression to me before, because we had a very good mother and daughter relationship. So,
right.
But I pushed that thought, that feeling away, and I just said, okay, you can call me later on tonight or tomorrow. And she said, well, we'll see about that, she said, and we hung up.
So she didn't specify if something in particular was wrong or anything like that?
No, she just said that was something she had to take care of herself.
Right.
And afterwards, thinking about it, I've been thinking that maybe when she knew that we would act if necessary, so we would absolutely come over and try to help her, there was a big problem, you know. Afterwards, I was thinking that maybe she thought that that would worsen the situation, or that maybe she wanted to protect us from something.
Hmm.
Because she was that kind of a girl, that she was a very, how to speak, a very strong, determined girl, so she was not scared of anything, really.
Right.
So that could have been like her, you know.
Right.
But at the time I thought, oh, well, that must be something about a boy or something, and well, I can't put my nose into everything, you know. So I just felt that, well, we will talk about it. And I was thinking of calling her the next day, and we had a lot to do at home with renovating this house, and so it didn't happen. And Sunday evening at 11:30 in the evening, three policemen and a priest came to our house and told us what had happened. And my immediate reaction was that somebody had killed her. I got that feeling because of the call we had on Friday. I felt there was something that had happened to her that was not well.
Right. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah.
Definitely. And so let's talk about actually what happened at that point here, in specifically from the perspective of Scotland, because here's kind of where the case gets I guess, more interesting because there's so many weird circumstances around the case. I mean, how was this treated, first of all, by the authorities in Scotland? How did the police there handle the case, and how was the information kind of revealed to you, Guia?
Well, firstly, it took me quite some time to get in touch with the right people. At first, they told me this was to be handled between the Scottish police and the Swedish police. After we got to know that Annie was dead, I immediately told the police everything I knew about her life in Scotland, and of people that they should talk to, and the situations that I had heard about. Since we had a very good mother-daughter relationship, I knew a lot about her life. So I told the Swedish police here in my kitchen that very night everything I knew, and they were going to inform Scottish police, and then they were going to handle the situation. But as soon as I could, the next morning I called the Swedish police to ask what news they had for me, and it showed they didn't even know about my daughter's case. So at that point, I immediately decided that I would make contact directly with the Scottish police, because I didn't want any information to get lost or misunderstood or misinterpreted.
Exactly.
So therefore, I started talking directly to the Scottish police when I found them. It took some time, but through the Swedish Council in Edinburgh, I finally found them in the afternoon. I think it was that Monday afternoon then, and I started talking to the Scottish police and informing them about everything that I knew.
Right. Were they accommodating in that regard and interested in, they wanted to hear as much as they could about this, or what happened?
I don't know. They listened all right, but I never got any questions from them about my daughter and her behavior or circumstances. So it felt like a one-way communication. I was sort of pumping information into them, and I didn't know where it took off,
right.
Because I didn't get any feedback, actually. And that was a very hard situation, and them talking Scottish was also a bit of a problem to me, because I was thinking maybe they didn't understand my English and I didn't understand their Scottish.
Right.
So, because actually the very first day that I spoke with the Scottish police, they told me that Annie had committed suicide. And it took me several days before I realized that they actually said that to me. But going through my notes, I can see that I actually wrote down that they said to me that Annie had committed a suicide. And that was, she was found Sunday morning, and that was Monday afternoon that they told me that.
Yeah.
And it was very hard to grasp to me, because I thought I must have something, trouble understanding them or something, because it was so out of the question to me, since I knew that I felt that Annie had been under some kind of a threat, and
yeah.
And then there were a lot of circumstances that had to be investigated, and they had not even started to investigate anything about her death, and still they told me this the very first day. So that was very strange to me.
Do you know how the Scottish police went about investigating the case, and how quickly did they come to their conclusions about that this was a suicide?
They told me every day for about six weeks that my daughter had committed a suicide. And I asked them to investigate a a whole bunch of occasions that could be of interest to them, but seemed they did very, very little. After 6 weeks, they actually changed their story, and that was after I had got in touch with the Swedish murder squad in Stockholm,
mm-hmm.
and they knew that they were coming over, so I suppose they understood that they couldn't claim a suicide when they had nothing to prove it,
right.
how to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, what do you think some of the reasons for this was? Why did it go in this direction? Why did they suddenly had to change their story?
Well, at that time also they began to talk to some of the people that Annie knew. So I suppose they wanted to show that now they were performing some kind of an investigation. I had no idea. Some people tell me that there are a lot of lack of resources. Some people have told me that listening to me telling about what happened, that the police must be hiding something, and you know, it's sometimes I think it's so incredible to think that the police would hide facts. Very hard for me to understand that, but
yeah.
I have no idea, of course, what's happening and what has happened, you know. So
now the main issue here then is that this has been deemed a suicide, and therefore certain legal, you know, things have occurred which has prevented them from investigating the case further. There's has been rejected to have a new probe into the case. The Crown Office have been involved in this as well. How well can you explain this to us of what happened here and what the legal framework, I guess, is in Scotland when it comes to this particular case?
Since there were many strange things about my daughter's death and the circumstances, I have asked to get the investigation out when it was closed. After 11 months, it was closed. And they decided it could have been a suicide, an accident, or a crime. But since there were no proofs of a crime, they were not going to investigate it further, they said. I then, during all the process, I have been in touch with Crown Office and other authorities. And several times, so I have a long list of letters I have been writing about my daughter's case to various authorities in Scotland. One of the things I have been doing is to get the information, the investigation released, so that I can see for myself what has been done and what has not been done. Since I have to do my own investigation, I want to know what they have done. But they do not release the information that are because they say it's not. I have asked in accordance to the Freedom of Information Act that I want. I have requested the investigation about my daughter's case and. The reply I have received is that my daughter's death is not in the public interest. So, therefore, they will not release the investigation to my family.
Very, very strange. Very, very strange. Now, before we carry on there and speculate a little bit more about why and whatnot, maybe you can talk a little bit about why you consider that this is not suicide and something else has happened. There's a number of inconsistencies and facts really in the case here at this point, from things that have been caught on CCTV footage and other things as well. So kind of lay that out for us if you can, Guya.
Of course it's like I told you about the last conversation I had with my daughter, that has made me aware of that something was happened to her the last days of her life. But I have also made my own investigation and put a schedule over her last time, so I know about various things that point to that something must have happened to her. But for to begin with, I could say something about where she was found. And she was found, as I think I said, about 80 kilometers away from where she lived. And she lived in Edinburgh, but was found in Prestwick, and that's the small community where the airport is situated then. And she was found in a walking distance from the airport on the beach. Annie was a strong swimmer, and this was the 4th of December. When she was found, her jacket and her bag was beside her on the beach. And in her bag, she had, for instance, her Swedish passport and two library books to a Swedish library nearby where we live. And we had been talking a lot about how she would give those books back in time, you know, how to return them in time.
Right.
And I also know that she had talked to the library to keep them for some longer. So we were talking a lot about those books, and those books, and I knew that she wanted to return them home. When she was, she was found at a place where there is a tide. To get into deep water to be able to drown yourself, when the tide is out, you have to walk out about 300 yards to get into deep water.
Right.
We have been speaking to locals. I can tell you that they do not even use ordinary boats there because it's so flat, you know, so they can only use boats without any, I don't know what you call that under the boat.
A keel.
Yeah, keel.
Yeah.
They can't use that kind of boat there because it's so flat.
Right.
So you have to walk very, very long out to be able to get into deep water. And when the tide is up, you know, it's never more than a meter along that
the bay there, or
it's a wall. It's a wall. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's a wall with an edge that keeps you from falling into the water if you would be drunk or something like that. You know?
Right.
So
yeah.
There's a esplanade where you can walk, and people walk there. They run there. They walk their dogs, and you can even drive a car there. But it's not allowed, of course, but we know that garbage cars and such like do drive there, and people that know the place probably know what poles to pull out, because we tried that and we could see that some of them were loose, so you actually can't drive with a car all the way down to the shore.
Right.
So it's the situation where she was found is very strange. It's an area where there is, where at the time it was rather dark, and you can't actually see people very easily if they walk there or do something there in the dark. She was found there on the shore in the sand, and it's very strange that both her, if she would have drowned herself, how would then both the jacket and the bag be found beside her? That that's one very strange thing.
Exactly.
I think. And like I just told you, there is nothing. You can't slip into the sea there because it's a small wall keeping you, preventing you from falling in. So.
Yeah.
And it's also very hard to think that Annie would have walked in this dark area. It's a bit too far away from the airport to be convenient, so to speak.
And there's no knowledge at this stage of how she would have gotten out there if it was doable to walk. Let's say if she got a ride or took a bus or something like that. That's,
yeah,
is that
we don't know that. No.
Okay.
No. And and then there, of course, there are the damages to her. She's hurt. We can see that since I took care of my daughter's body myself, I could see when she was returned to Sweden, I could see several bruisings on her body, that some of them not mentioned in the autopsy report.
Right.
So, this is something I noticed, and also the funeral company who took care of her body together with me when she was returned to Sweden. There were several bruisings that are not explained in the autopsy report, and scratches and so on. And then another awful thing was that she had unusually thick, very long, waist-long hair, and when we got her back home, the hair was chopped off.
Chopped off?
Yeah, and we have no idea of where that happened, because we have tried to investigate that, but the Scottish police say that we have reported that in Sweden. Since we discovered it in Sweden, we reported it in Sweden, and they have stated that the crime has occurred abroad and evidence is not available in Sweden. So, therefore, we have reported it to the Scottish police. However, they refused to take the report up, since they say it's not desecration to chop a dead person's hair off. And they have asked us to report it to England, since her body was transported through London. And I went to London, tried to report it to the London police, and they too refused to take the report up, since they said that this was a Scottish matter.
Oh, boy.
So,
So no one, it's a bureaucracy nightmare on top of this as well, to make things even worse. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you, what has the Swedish police or authorities done to help you out in any way when it comes to this case? Have they been accommodating and helpful or rejectful as the other authorities?
I would use their own words then, because they say that they are not allowed to interfere into another country's investigation. That's what I have been told.
Okay.
And I have also asked Swedish Foreign Office for help, and they tried actually to request the Scottish investigation about my daughter's case, and the Scottish authorities refused to give it to them, so they couldn't help anymore, they said. So that's the situation in Sweden.
Now, I think I read on your website, Julia, that it says, to get Annie's death thoroughly investigated, we also need a fatal accident injury, FIA, into... into Annie's mysterious death. And that's something you've been trying to request, but denied. How would you go about getting one of these? What needs to be done there, do you think?
Well, I don't know, really. That's my problem. As I told you, we have done our own investigation into this, and when we pulled ourselves together, actually we had another autopsy in Sweden of my daughter, and we had to wait for that for 6 months. And then we had another autopsy in Sweden, since I felt that that must be necessary. The Scottish autopsy, we find not to be very thorough. We felt that we have to have another autopsy. And unfortunately, they couldn't say very much on that autopsy either, because even if a body is in a deep freeze condition, it still changes, and it's not not that fresh that you would need it to be.
Right.
So, however, I managed to, I have always wondered if she really drowned at the place where she was found, you know, I wanted them to look, to investigate what kind of water was found in her internal organs. At the Swedish autopsy, they actually took some material that was sent to Strasbourg. An expert on diatoms there could see that the diatoms found in my body's daughter's body belongs in fresh sweet water.
Right.
I don't know the exact, how do you say that in English?
Yeah, I think it's fresh water. Yeah.
And the place where my daughter was found, the salt water there.
Yeah.
So this particular diatom, Naviatula lanceolata, that's the name of it, should not be, if my daughter had drowned in seawater, in the salt seawater, then there should be also other species that live in salt seawater and not just this sweet water diatom, Naviatula lanceolata.
Yeah, yeah.
So, at our opinion, this shows that my daughter did not drown at this location where she was found.
And at this point, you believe that she might have been taken there, basically, as a and planted, if you will, because there was something else going on here. And I know that there's wide speculations of what could have happened. We could talk about some of that later, but. Let's go back a little bit again and just talk about there are a couple of people here as well that have been popping up. One I was reading about earlier today, for example, was the rugby player from New Zealand, Martin. I forget his last name.
Martin Leslie.
Yeah, yeah. Martin Leslie. Well, tell us about that. What happened there?
My daughter in the summer of 2005. Half a year before she died, she met a man calling himself Martin Leslie. He was a rather famous rugby star from New Zealand, and she met him at some pub, not the pub, maybe a nightclub, I think it was. And the problem is we have tried, and we did contact, finally we got in contact with Martin Leslie and his sister-in-law, and they say that Martin Leslie did not, had not been in Scotland for 2 years when my daughter died. So they claim that the man who told Annie that he was Martin Leslie must have been another man using his name as an imposter.
Huh.
So, and we also know that Annie met this man who called himself Martin Leslie the last days of her life, once at a rugby gathering. There was some kind of festivities at the club. She used to go to rugby clubs, rugby games, and so on, and knew a lot of people that worked there and and players and so on. And she met this man that she thought was Martin Leslie some days before she died, and also December 1st when she went swimming. There was a place called the Delry Swim Center where she used to go and swim. And from an email we can see that she met this man at that occasion. But being in contact with the family, they say that this man must have been somebody claiming to be Martin Leslie. So that's something that we really would need more information about.
Yeah, and he's spoken out, I think, and said, I haven't, as you detailed, I haven't been back to Scotland in 2 years, and I don't know who this person is. And he also offered her, I guess, champagne at two occasions and two different evenings there, but she refused due to the fact that she didn't see the glass being poured, right?
Yeah, she was a bit cautious because she knew about girls that had been drugged through drinks and so on. So even if she liked this person very much, she did not want to drink out that champagne because you never know. She was being a girl, you have to be aware.
Be cautious.
That,
yeah, of course.
There can be things happening to you.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And the boy, this man, he repeatedly asked her to drink, but he didn't drink, and my daughter didn't drink. So there was, it feels like there was something strange about the drinks there. Why didn't the man drink himself then, or his friend who was with him?
Indeed. Now, what do we know here about the CCTV footage and how late, what is the latest footage that we see, and how close is that to, it's just the evening or the day before she was found, correct?
It took the police quite some time to I of course asked immediately about CCTV from the airport or the trains or buses, or to establish how she got there and to see if she was talking to somebody. She was a very talkative girl, you know, and talked a lot, and people noticed her because she was tall and broad shoulders, very long blonde hair, and very friendly and polite and so on. So to me it was important to see if somebody had noticed her or been talking to her to get some kind of information about how she got there and so on. However, the police never requested the CCTV from the trains or, as it seems, nothing from the road, from, if you say that, well, it's quite some distance, those 80 kilometers from where she lived on, all the way to Prestwick Airport, and still the only CCTV they found was from the airport, and that took 3.5 months before they located my daughter at these films then. And the problem now is that the time schedule does not fit, because we have had very good help from the Scottish Review, the editor, and some girl from the staff there has performed the same walk, and there are several minutes missing from the distance that my daughter was supposed to have been walking that Saturday afternoon. Then she was last seen there, according to the police, about 3:15 until 3:18 or something. So,
right.
According to the CCTV, she very rapidly comes in the direction from the train platform at the airport, walks through a walking pad, tunnel, what to call it, and down the escalator out of the main entrance, stays at the car parking, and then comes back the same way, and doing the same walk, Mr. Kent Roy and his one of the girls in his staff can establish that there are several minutes missing. You can't walk that distance
right.
during that time period.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of things for the police to look into.
Yeah.
And it's very strange that if there would be something wrong with the CCTV on an airport like Prestwick Airport in these days when there are fears of terrorist attacks and everything, the CCTV footage ought to be correct, don't you think?
Absolutely, of course. No, that's
so,
yeah.
So we cannot understand why there are several minutes missing from my at my daughter's walk
yeah.
during that distance.
She never bought a flight ticket to back to Gothenburg, back to Sweden, correct?
We don't know, of course, but they say that she did not buy anything at the internet, but we know that maybe she wanted to buy a standby ticket. And, you know, at that time of the year, I would say that I have been there several times that time of the year, and 30% of the seats are empty, so that would not be a problem.
Okay.
But according to the police, they say she has never been in to a counter to buy something, according to the CCTV. But as I told you, the minutes doesn't fit, so we don't know about that. There was one plane leaving the same night, 2 hours about 6 o'clock in the evening, something, and the other one 8 or 8:30 the next morning. So she could very well have taken either of them. One of them went to Gothenburg, that's the closest to where we live, and the other one was to nearby Stockholm, where her best friend lives. So she could have taken either of them.
Right. So,
yeah.
So to piece together the time or potential the scenario there, then she shows up at the airport with probably an intention at that point to buy a ticket to get onto a plane either that same day or early the next morning.
You think so? Because she had an appointment with her hairdresser on Monday.
Right.
So she should have bought a ticket to come home.
But she doesn't, probably then. Well,
we don't know.
No.
We don't know.
She was also seen talking with the two men at a parking lot at the airport, correct?
No, I don't know about that. I think somebody, I don't know who it was, I think it was somebody at the police told me that she was talking to two men on the shore, but I'm not certain about that. A lot of people say a lot of things and you don't get to know then what was the... Was it correct or was it not?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's right. At the short press, and when do we know what time that was? The witness saw this.
I think it was about 4:30, the same time that she should have been there, but if she went there by herself, but I have no more information about that.
What do you think happened here then, if we could speculate for a moment and just kind of go over some of the different possibilities of what could have happened to her? There was another call, I'm jumping into back and forth here, but that's okay. One of the calls in terms of being, she was worried about someone tracking her online, right?
What has happened? We have, for instance, about the calls, we have figured out that when she called home, she did not use the phone in her apartment. Instead, she called from a phone booth rather far away from where she lived. And she also told her brother that we should not call on her phone since somebody could hear. And we thought at the time, could that have been some of the girls in the apartment that would overhear her saying something to us, or what could that be? But, you know, that was very strange. But after looking into the phone bills and so on, we can see that she She actually called home from, not from the apartment where there was a landline. Instead, she went rather far away to call home from other places. We don't know if that's a coincidence or not, but saying somebody could hear, that is very strange. And then later on, getting access to the phone bills and so on from the Linton Court apartment, we also could see that her phone calls made to her very best friend in Sweden have been erased. They had never been, my daughter had never had to pay for them, and her best friend in Sweden never had to pay for those telephone calls. So it seems somebody has been able to manipulate the phone bills, and I can't understand why. I can also see in her email at her email account that somebody has been, it seems like somebody has been manipulating emails. A lot of emails are gone that should not have been gone, and and about the phone calls, so one that is left is placed at the wrong date. So it seems somebody has been able to manipulate both the email conversation and the telephone conversation.
Now, did Annie have a computer that now you have, or was it an online mail account?
No, she had a computer with her, but she didn't have internet access at where she lived, so she used ordinary internet cafes.
Right.
She went to them and made her wrote her emails there. So,
There's a lot of unexplained things here and weird details and everything else. Now, before we carry on in that regard, I know that there's a couple of people as well that you've been trying to get in contact with or you know, basically so that something else is done in Scotland. Alexander Salmon and then Angiolino, I think her name is as well. What has happened there?
Yeah, I have been writing to lots of them and I must say that the Prime Minister, Mr. Alex Salmond, was very helpful and nice to us because he listened carefully to my daughter, to my me telling about my daughter's case. But he's a minister, but still he can't interfere into the work of Crown Office. So he asked Crown Office to look again at my daughter's case, and some help we did get because we actually got the CCTV. It took me a lot of time, but I think it was him putting a big pressure on the Crown Office, so I actually got the CCTV images out, for instance.
Right.
And he also said that if we find evidence ourselves, we are welcome to present that to the authorities. So that's one reason I have been trying to investigate my daughter's death on my own, because they actually have promised that if I find something of importance, they will look into it. So that's my hope that actually they will do that as well.
Well,
so
I mean, you've already found a lot, and as you said, that very good article series at the ScottishReview.net by Kenneth Roy details a tremendous amount of material. Do you know if they actually have looked at that? There's something in the wings waiting on that series now as well, right?
Well, we are still waiting for their reply to if they will open my daughter's case or not. I really do hope for that.
Sure.
I have also tried to. I have had a lot of correspondence with the Crown Office, for instance, about the DNA found on my daughter. It's very strange that even though the police claims that she had been lying for several hours in the water. Still, there were DNA on her hands from an unknown woman. So I have asked them, at the time when it was found, they did a match. They tried to match it at the current DNA register, but they didn't find any match. And I have asked the Crown Office to do that again for me, but they have refused. So I hope that if they do open my daughter's case, they will also try to match, because if this person was not in the register in 2005, maybe she is now, you know, and because that would be very interesting to see why my daughter has DNA from an unknown woman on her body, on her hands, when they claim that she has been in the water for a long time. And we actually doubt that she was in water for very long, since there are no sand described in her mouth or ears or eyes or something like that. So it seems she was placed there. Otherwise, she should have had a lot of sand in her throat and so on. So that's very strange.
And it's actually very difficult to drown oneself as well if you do not have weight or anything like that. Your body reflexes takes over after a certain point, and you go up in the surface. And as you said, just to detail that as well, it's very, very shallow here. It's, you know, about 3 feet, about 1 meter. So that would be very difficult.
At the most, it's 1 meter.
At the most, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and they did not found if a person drowns her or him. Well, girls very seldom drown themselves. And if a person drowns themselves, then they often have some kind of drugs in their remains.
Yeah.
And there was nothing found in my daughter's remains. So,
and there wasn't a lot of alcohol or anything like that involved, of course?
No, there was a very, very, very small amount of alcohol. And like if she had a beer the other night or something like that.
Right.
That was all. So people that drown themselves, they used to take drugs to be able to go through with that.
Yeah.
And most of all, my daughter was a very lively, happy girl, and if she had a problem, she dealt with it, and she went on in life, we had a good mother and daughter relationship. She had her best friend here in Sweden and other friends. She always had somebody to talk to if there was a problem, in case she didn't want to deal with it herself, you know, but... and maybe that was what she chose this time, to deal with it herself. And I have of course no clue what happened to her, but my knowing Annie, I get the feeling that maybe she was an ordinary girl, you know, but very lively and talkative and so on. And I sometimes wonder if she got to see or hear something that she should not know about.
Right.
That she just was in the way of something,
in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, somebody would think that this girl might talk when she goes back home or something.
Right.
But I have no idea about what kind of criminality there are in Edinburgh, if there is a mafia or there is drug dealers or there are what kind of people are there are, you know. I have no idea of what she could have been witnessing, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe she even tried to help somebody. Because she was very, that kind that she was not scared of anything, and she could deal with any situation except for this last one. Then she could have tried to help somebody who was a prostitute or something.
Right.
But she herself would never use drugs. She was not a criminal. She was not a prostitute. She was an ordinary girl. And
yeah.
still this happened to her.
Yeah.
And that's so strange. And then my first thought when all this happened was that, well, now the police will start to investigate this. And that's why I told them everything I knew about my daughter's life in Edinburgh and everybody that she knew and all the kind of situations I knew about. And so I was very surprised then when nothing happened at their end.
Well, exactly. And this is as well why I think you make a good point there, that maybe she just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. There's some other... I mean, it could be related to something else, basically, something sensitive. There's even another, I forget the source of that, but it was a speculation that this might have been a case of basically mistaken identity, and that there was actually intelligence services, either MI5, MI6, or maybe even the CIA, that actually was involved in an assassination, but actually were consequently forced to cover it up because this was a big mistake. And that's one of the reasons why the authorities have put the lid on in the way that they have.
A lot of strange things are happening on Prestwick Airport. That's what I have heard.
give me some examples.
I have heard about CIA planes stopping there to load bombs for further transportation to other countries. So there are a lot of things happening there.
Well, that's very interesting. What else do you know about that? Can you tell us where you heard that from?
I don't know very much, but that's some of the things that the special kind of equipment that you need when you do these bombings, and they are made nearby Prestwick and are put on the planes in Prestwick. That was something that was happening during the time when my daughter died. So I of course do not know if this has anything to do with my daughter's death, but there have been a lot of people investigating this, and these are facts.
Let me just read a couple of quick headlines here. When you Google Prestwick Airport CIA, a couple of interesting ones come up. Basically, Google Earth fingers CIA rendition flights, and this points to Prestwick Airport's Rice admits CIA flight mistakes. And this is from Prestwick Airport News Stories. Then you have another exclusive from the Daily Record back in 2009. CIA torture plane lands at Prestwick Airport.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
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 So she might have seen something that she shouldn't have
seen. That's the feeling I get, that she saw or heard something that she should not know about. And I often wonder who has the power and the technique to erase telephone calls and go into email accounts and, at the same time talking about these things. If you wouldn't know me before, you would think I'm crazy. But most people that know me think that I'm an ordinary person with a... I'm not insane,
And
still these things, these are facts that pop up, and
right.
those are possibilities just like everything else.
Exactly.
We used to say, Annie's dead, so everything is possible.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I mean, you have the reason to look under every, in every nook and cranny, under the rugs and in the, shadowy corners, if you will, and if this is where it leads, then that is where it leads, right?
Yeah. It's like living in an action movie, but I didn't choose this.
No.
And my daughter didn't, but we are here. We can't do anything about it.
Well, if nothing else, then it also shows the insanity of the intelligence apparatus. If this is indeed where it does lead, because it shows that just an innocent bystander can be, treated or effectively, terminated in this way for whatever reason and incentive they might have to do this. But it's disgusting if that's the case,
You would think that before this happened, this was something you saw on people getting killed for various reasons, that's something that belongs in the movies or in a crime story, but now we're living, it feels sometimes like I'm living in one until I know what happened to her. Maybe it was just a jealous boyfriend who killed her. I have no idea, you know.
Yeah.
But these other elements exist, so they are worth investigating as well as everything else.
Well, absolutely, and I think one of the biggest clues here is the way that there's been an active cover-up. There seems to have been information erased or changed or for whatever reason to lead people astray. And then, I mean, I want people to think about this as well, that you have basically, that you have taken over and handled the murder investigation at this case, because basically no one else is helping you out to the extent that they should anyway.
Yeah, we have to. I have been measuring the tide myself, wearing plastic bags, all my up to my waist, wandering out in the water with what you call those sticks to measure how many centimeters the water is.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I have been walking out into the water with these plastic bags on my body to be able to perform these tests.
Yeah.
I have put we put bags with the material in the water to see how fast it would sink. We have done a lot of these kinds of tests, just, and we have documented them with pictures to show what we, if the police are interested, we have the material for them to look into.
Yeah.
So we have an entire investigation on our hands, but we of course need the police to do the more thorough investigations, because we can't force people to talk to us.
No, exactly. They do have access to certain things, and they can open up records and make people talk and everything else.
Yeah, if I ask somebody, they can refuse to answer, or most of the time they are very friendly and so on. And then when you try to get back to them, they have disappeared. You know.
Yeah.
So that's a very strange situation. You talk to somebody, and then next time you want to talk to that man or woman, the phone is out of order, or they are on vacation, or this or that. And we have always been very nice and polite to everybody. So sometimes you're asking yourself, have they been threatened or something?
Right. Yeah. Anything is possible.
And at the same time, you know, is this my fantasy, or are those things happening in reality? You know.
Yeah. We talk quite often about these kinds of things on the program. So to us, it's not a big surprise, really. It's just very unfortunate and sad that it comes in this particular context that we're talking about today, but it does show the other side, if you will, the more when this connects, if you will, with just regular people's lives, if you will. And again, we're not saying that this is the case, but if evidence pointing to this area, they seem to be the strongest in this case, I think, in a way, than just some random act, because if that was the case, then they wouldn't have the power to keep it out of the books in this way and alter information, you know?
Mm. Yeah, I'm very disappointed that it's so hard to get material out, since the police say that they cannot, until now have said that they will not investigate, since there are no proofs of a crime. Then I think the material should be left to me, so I can go on with the investigation.
Yeah, you're doing the work. They should.
Since it's my daughter, and I want to know what they have done, so I can go on with it. But if I'm lucky now, maybe they will open it. That would be great. But we don't know yet if they will take my daughter's case seriously and go on with it. We don't know that.
Well, I really hope that it does, and I hope that because of all the work you have done so far, and you know, just your determination in this case, that the things, that doors, if you will, start to open up for you. Now, you go over to Scotland, I believe, then basically you have gone over every December since this happened?
Yeah, most of the years, it's been very tiresome, the whole situation, so I actually got very ill at the end, so no, I have not been there for 2 years, because I got a very serious pneumonia, and I had to, stop for a while and think on my health.
Sure, yeah.
Because nobody benefits if I too die of exhaustion.
Of course.
I have not been there for some time now.
Now, what else can be done then, do you think, at this stage? And I mean, I want you, I guess, relay some information further to our listeners here as well. I mean, everyone out there, obviously, listening in Scotland, if you don't know anything, you need to spread this program to the people that you do know, in the hope that somebody, however small the detail might be, anybody out there might be sitting on something that could be very beneficial to you, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially the person that, there are some persons that lived at the Linton Court Apartments at the same time as my daughter, so it would be very interesting to talk to some of those. So if some of them listens to this program, I would be very, I would very much appreciate if they would contact your radio, and you could give me their names, and I could talk to them about my daughter and see what they remembers. Maybe they don't think that they have anything special to tell, but they might have something that, together with other material, could be of importance. So that would be very interesting if they would be able to contact you about that.
Certainly. I mean, we'll be glad to help out in this case and contact, any contact further to you, Guyu. And I wish again that everyone out there who's listening to this, help Guyu out and see if there's any information that you can, you know, come to with this case.
We know that something happened the last bit. We know that something important or serious happened the last time of her life. So especially that week, everybody that met Annie during that last week or previous to that as well, but we know something happened, so we need to find out what and who she saw and what she told people and so on during that week. That would be very interesting.
Now, I just want to say as well, I think you're very brave and courageous and, of course, strong to be able to do this and do what you do, and I wish that information will come your way, that some doors will open up here, and that eventually, of course, you will find out what actually happened to be able to get, you know, closure and in that regard move forward. I mean, this is something that has taken up a lot of time, obviously, of your life, and you're dedicated to finding the answers to this. So I really hope that things open up for you.
Yeah, thank you. We hope so too, because we will never get Annie back. We know that, but the least thing we can do for her and for ourselves, and that's to get to know what happened to her. That would be, I think she's worth the truth, you know, my daughter is worth that the truth will come out, and that's what we hope for.
I, of course, want to leave you whatever else you want to mention to us or to our audience that we haven't talked about yet, but I also want you to mention the website where you can, where people can find articles. You have more information, newspaper clippings. You even have, I believe, a reward for anybody who can help you out, right?
Yeah, actually. We have a Harley Davidson motorcycle that's a reward for those who can give important information about Annie's case. So it's here in my house waiting for the right person to collect it.
Yeah.
So we have a website, it's not newly updated because, well, it's usually my son who does that, and it's hard for him to deal with these things, so it's not updated for a long time, but I hope we will do that in the nearest future, because there's more information to put there. If somebody wants to read it, it's www.annierockstar.com.
Annierockstar.com. We will have that linked up as well on our website, and I urge everyone then to take a look there and find out. And do you and they can, if there's someone who's anonymous, because for whatever might be sensitive to them.
There is also an address and a web email address where they can write, and they can also write something in the guest book if they want to.
Yes,
they're very welcome.
Very good. Now, is there anything else you'd like to leave us with, or anything else, details that we have left out so far before we wrap things up for this time, Guru?
I suppose there is a lot, but it's hard to comprehend all that we have done for these 8 years, of course, and most of all, it's hard to comprehend who Annie was and how important she was to us and to other people, to our family, everybody, like a grandmother, or, you know, like her friends, best friends, her school friends, you know, her working colleagues. A lot of people liked Annie, you know, so, and a lot of people are devastated that this has happened, and nobody knows what to do, you know. So we're all in a lot of pain because this has happened to Annie, you know.
Yeah.
We try to go on with our lives, but until we know what happened, that is very hard, you know.
Well,
very,
certainly,
very hard.
Certainly. Well, yeah. I'm sorry for everything that has happened consequently, but you know, again, you're very brave, and you know, please keep up that work, and I hope that you have you mm-hmm. find the strength and courage to do that. So. Thank you so much for your time today, Guria. I wish you the best. I hope that more information will come your way soon. So thank you for doing this with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
We are going to switch over to Tom Minogue shortly here. Just before we do that, though, there is an interesting side story here to this that we did not talk that much about in regards to the case of mistaken identity. Now, Annie's middle name is Christina. There is an American freelance journalist and documentary filmmaker by the name of Christina Börjesson. Or it's actually Börjesson because it's without the ö in Swedish. But she is a former CBS producer who investigated flight TWA-800, a Boeing that exploded and crashed into the Atlantic Ocean near New York. You might remember it's back in July 17th, 1996. The investigations and the two documentaries that she has done on this brings to light the fact that there was a, wait for it, Navy drill going on at the same time as this plane blew up midair. Several eyewitnesses saw something that traveled with quick speed towards the plane before it exploded. The documentaries are quite revealing, and they have a number of eyewitnesses and experts and everything else that indicates, obviously, that something is terribly, horribly wrong with the official story. Now, it turns out that the Mail on Sunday, the paper out of the UK, reported about the connection to Christina Börjesson, not Annie Börjesson, and that she allegedly had been investigating CIA rendition flights through Prestwick Airport in Scotland, the very airport where Annie died, or were last seen. And so an excerpt from the Mail on Sunday article reads as follows. In a further shock twist, the family discovered that just weeks before Miss Börjesson's mysterious death, an investigative reporter with a very similar name had exposed details of secret CIA rendition flights transporting terrorists to torture camps via Prestwick, something the U.S. authorities had strongly denied. On the day Christina Börjesson broke the news, the U.S. spy agency was using the airport for flights. Annie, whose middle name on her passport is also Christina, had passed through arrivals. 7 weeks later, she was dead. So 1 week later, the same paper published a correction that reads, "On February 2nd, an article, 'Did the CIA kill my daughter?' in a bungled hit on journalists over torture flights, wrongly suggested American investigative journalist Kristina Börjesson had published an expose of CIA rendition flights through Prestwick Airport. We now accept that this was not correct and offer our apologies. Although Ms. Börjesson had carried out a number of high-profile exposés in her illustrious career, the revelation about rendition flights was incorrectly attributed to her." It goes on to say, "We are also happy to point out Ms. Börjesson does not believe there is any link between her work and the 2005 death in Prestwick of Swedish woman Annie Börjesson." Interesting, isn't it? It's been very difficult to check if Kristina Börjesson actually reported on CIA rendition flights or not. Even Tommy Nog asked the U.S. journalist on her Twitter account without getting a definitive answer. Now, Guria claims that there was an article written by Kristina the same month then that Annie entered into Scotland at Prestwick, but that this has since many years back been removed from the internet. So we still don't know more about this connection, if there is any indeed. So what I'll do is I'll link to these articles and the posts on this program page on redicecreations.com so you can read more for yourself. Plus, check out more on the TWA 800 story, which is fascinating itself, by the way. All right, but we'll switch over now to Tom Minogue, a justice campaigner and petitioner to the Scottish Parliament, who has been helping Guille and helping out in this case, as he has some insight to share with us on this particular investigation and why things are the way they are in Scotland. Welcome, Tom. Thank you so much for taking the time talking with us. It's great to have you here.
Sure. Nice to be here, Henrik, and anything I can do to help, could you?
You bet. So we've heard the background on the case now from Guille herself, and we've understood that something is very wrong with how the case has been handled in Scotland, very much resistance to us. But maybe first you can just tell us how you've tried to help Guille and what you've been trying to do in Scotland in order to get this case to be opened up a bit more.
Well, I've confined my help to Guille to practical ways. She's a stranger in my country, a foreigner in my country. She's been treated badly by the authorities. So I try and redress that balance a bit, if you like, by being helpful in a practical way, if I can be of any help to her, in with her petition or, you know, to get her to her house and have a nice meal and get away from all of the dirty little hostels and things she's having to stay in to save money when she comes over here regularly to try and investigate and find out more about what happened to her daughter on the day she died. So practical help is what I try and give her, because I do feel a bit ashamed that she's not been treated properly in our country, and that's wrong. That upsets me.
Now, why do you think she hasn't been treated right? She has been trying to push, of course, to get more information to be opened up about this case, and it's been very, very difficult for her. Why is that, do you think?
Well, it's the way things are done in Scotland. There's a reluctance to have an investigation into a case of sudden death where it could or could not be suicide. And the trend is always in Scotland to say it was suicide without an investigation. And the people who determine this suicide are the police and the procurator fiscal, who are the public prosecutors. And they work very close together, so there are often cosy relationships there. And it's far easier for them to say this was a suicide than, well, we don't know what it is, and it requires further investigation. And in Scotland, there's no need for a full investigation. They can just presume suicide, whereas in England, there's no presumption of suicide. There's got to be full evidence. You can't just assume it. You've got to have a full evidence examination, just the same as you would in a homicide. But in Scotland, no, that's not needed. You can just say it's suicide, and then, of course, the crime statistics look good. There's no unsolved murder, no suspicious death, and that's it. And there have been some very, very high-profile cases in Scotland that cause a lot of the population to wonder what's going on. I think the most famous one, I suppose, or infamous, would be the Billy Harrison case in Glasgow. This was a young man who was very drunk and died in a Glasgow alleyway, one of these alleyways that frequented by prostitutes and a sort of seedy part of the city, male prostitutes and female prostitutes. And Billy Harrison was found dead with wounds to the back of his head on a stairway. And the police said suicide. His parents weren't satisfied, and they were lucky to have a good MP who took it all the way, and they investigated it, and he raised questions in Parliament and Westminster, and there was a television documentary run on the case, and Billy Harrison got examined independently by the parents. They got a coroner to look at it, or a pathologist, and they found that there had been 5 separate wounds on the back of his head. And the police still insisted it was suicide and said he was very drunk, he fell down, hit his head, the back of his head, then he got up again, fell down, hit his head again, the same place, got up again, fell down, hit his head in the same place, and did this 5 times. Now, it beggars belief that could happen. And eventually, the death was treated as a suspicious death and possible murder. But the family had to move heaven and earth to get this done, and there's just this tendency. Another man who is at Parliament just now, Stuart Graham, his stepson, a guy Colin, he had been stabbed once in the chest after a row with his girlfriend, right through his breastbone, right in the centre of the chest, and it was classed as suicide. And he eventually pressed and got a fatal accident inquiry. But the fatal accident inquiry doesn't allow the family, the bereaved parents or the bereaved loved ones, to have access to the information that they're dealing with. Unlike in England, where a fatal accident inquiry is a coroner who looks after it, somebody independent from the police and the prosecuting, and the families can question and see the evidence. In Scotland, it's very much They keep their cards close to their chest and they won't let the family see anything. And just on the numbers between England and Scotland, in England in a year there are 30,000, average of about 30,000 recently public inquests held by an independent coroner. And while in Scotland there are only between 50 to 70 fatal accident inquiries, and these are mainly, in fact, 99% of them would be for deaths at work, you know, industrial accidents. So the whole culture in Scotland is not good for investigating deaths that are suspicious in any way, and there's a tendency to label anything that, if, you know, as long as somebody's not got a bullet through their head, it's a suicide.
Right. Well, this is very interesting, Tom, because it would enable pretty much, it's a framework legal here where potentially if someone wanted to, you know, actually murder somebody and make it look like a suicide, then that would be something that would be very easy to do in Scotland, correct?
Absolutely. In Scotland, it's got no unsolved murders virtually, but it's got the third highest suicide rate in Europe. So,
oh, boy, yeah.
It makes you very suspicious. So this was background to my assistance to Gucci. She's not the only one. There are so many cases like this. You know, I could go on. There was the Kevin MacLeod case in Wick Harbour. Man found in the harbour after drinking in a pub and being in an argument and a bit of a fight. And he's later found floating in the dock. And there are trainer marks on his face. Suicide. Old woman Annie Davis found in her house. There are photos on the internet showing you Annie Davis. She looks like she's been in 10 round with a boxer, an old 80-year-old woman. Bags missing, purse is gone. The police say she's fallen down the stairs. You know, injuries that couldn't possibly be that. So there are many glaring cases. And I'm not saying that Guya's daughter was a glaring case, but that's the background I come to from, you know.
Yeah.
And there's as much evidence that Annie Borgeson was murdered as there is that she committed suicide, which is none. In fact, there are quite a few factors point to the murder, but, you know, there's nothing, not a thing suggesting that she committed suicide other than she was found in the water. So, yeah, your point's good. Yes, of course, it lends itself to if somebody wants to do away with somebody, yes, they could murder them, knock them on the head and throw them in the water. And in Scotland, that would be a suicide unless you were caught in the act.
Well, exactly. Very interesting. Now, you have, of course, been a justice campaigner and a petitioner to the Scottish Parliament, you know, calling for secret society membership to be actually mm-hmm. declared for judges and jurors, etc.
Yeah.
What, I mean, that's interesting in itself, but what is the background to this overall mentality, do you think? I think you kind of take it back historically a little bit, why this is the case, right?
Yes. Scotland led in so many fields. It was a very advanced country in history, you know, in the Enlightenment, which sort of led in Europe in advances in medicine, in banking, in justice. You know, they have this reputation, and of course, in the Industrial Revolution, they were the greatest shipbuilders in the world, the greatest football team in the world, the greatest bankers. They were leaders in all these fields, and today they're leaders in none of them. In fact, there's no shipbuilding to speak of. There's no bank after the recent crash. And I think Scotland have just rested on their laurels. They thought that because they were good at it in those days, there was no need to move with the times, and they've just got lazy and sat back. And Scotland's a small place, and they're very, very protective of their reputation. And of course, if anybody criticises the way they do things and wants change, then they circle the wagons. They are very defensive about any suggestion that they're still not the best justice system, the best banking system, and of course they're not. So
is that why Gyuri has been treated in the way she has, do you think? Because she's kind of been critical about this, or?
No, because as I say, there are people like Billy Harrison's family and et cetera in Scotland who have been treated just the same way.
Right.
But anybody who wants justice and isn't just prepared to accept what the police tell you, they're going to circle the wagons. They're going to defend themselves, and it's a difficult situation. And there's a petition at Parliament just now with the stepfather of a chap who committed suicide by stabbing himself violently in the chest after a row with his girlfriend. He's trying to get the system changed, but he's having trouble, and the Justice Minister won't even meet him. It's sad, and the same happened with Gyuri when she was here. She organised a march for justice down the Royal Mile in Edinburgh, and hundreds followed her, presented her petition to the Parliament, and the Justice Minister just wouldn't take the time to come out and see her. Although Gyuri is very resourceful, and she managed to see Alex Salmond, the First Minister, for a half-hour chat. But no, Scotland is very, very conservative and doesn't want to change.
Yeah. Now, what would it take, do you think, to actually get a change in the legal framework to get all these cases to be treated in a different way? What would it take?
I don't know, really, because the petition system in the Scottish Parliament is a great system, and it was the jewel in the crown of the Parliament when it got devolved way back there some years ago. And it allowed a citizen to change the law. So it was tailor-made for people like Gyuri and this chap, Stuart Graham, who's petitioning at the Parliament just now. Where there was faults in the law, they could come and they not get their loved ones' cases investigated again, but they could use them as examples of the flaws in the law. And if Gyuri's case was anything, it was an example of what was wrong with the law in Scotland. She couldn't find out anything. She still hasn't had a fatal accident inquiry. You know, no investigation. The police have decided it's suicide, and the basis of their investigations that they say they've had, which don't appear to amount to much, they won't share them with her, they won't give them to her. So it's just we say it as a suicide, and that's it, basically. So if you can't change, if you can't show that as being unsatisfactory, and Guyi got over 3,000 supporters from 57 countries agreeing with her that it was unsatisfactory, if that's not an example to change the law, I don't know what is. And yet, it was just dismissed out of hand.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I mean, this is where I think is most remarkable, that she is effectively from another country, led the murder investigation herself, pretty much. She's been going over to Scotland, knocking on doors and everything else, right?
Yeah. Every year she was coming, and I think her health prevented her the last year or two. But yes, every year she came at least once, round about Christmas, and sometimes in through the year. And she would go and try and find out things, and knocking on people's doors and asking them, did they see Annie that morning? What was she wearing? What was she doing? Who were her friends? This is a woman, a middle-aged woman, shouldn't be doing that, shouldn't have to do that. And to save pennies, she's staying in working men's hostels and, you know, mixed hostels with, you know, young homeless guys, drunks, what have you. She did this year after year, and she's very resourceful, and she's done marvelously well, but at the end of the day, she was just dismissed as, you know, sort of, as a paranoid sort of mother. But there was no evidence to suggest her daughter had committed suicide, and I felt just so sorry for her. And she's well admired, and, I mean, she's attracted some many friends in Scotland, campaigners, and many newspapers have run articles on them. But the establishment in Scotland just treats these sort of protests with contempt.
Well, it's very interesting that now, you know, I don't want to take it off too much of the topic here, but do you think that there is a gatekeeping issue here with the secret societies, the Freemasonic network at the heart of it, where Scotland basically is a place where you now could murder somebody and get away with it as a suicide, you know?
Well, what Freemasonry does, and I've had a lifetime of experience in observing it in industry mainly, but what it does is it lets talentless people rise to positions that their merit would never have achieved. So basically you've got duffers in top jobs who aren't up to the job, but they've got there by virtue of the fact, you know, that they've got the right handshake
and
the right connections. And this is the main thing. It's the very antithesis of meritocracy.
Yeah.
And so, yes, you're going to get this sloppy set up. And, yes, you're going to get people covering up for each other. And it's a hot topic again in England. It has been in the past in England, where the Parliament brought in laws requiring judges and policemen to register. But basically the police especially just cocked a snook at the laws and wouldn't really cooperate. And in this phone hacking scandal in England, of course you've got Freemasonry raising its head again, where the Metropolitan Police are very, very Masonic force. The investigation into the Hillsborough cover-up of the tragedy when there was 96 Liverpool supporters killed at Hillsborough. The investigation into that's been found to be corrupt. And now, because of concerns by the families, Freemason policemen have been banned from investigating that. So if you've got these problems in England, Scotland has four times per capita more Masonic membership than England. So, yes, Scotland's a wee place, and you've got all these cosy relationships, and it certainly is a bar to justice.
Well, this is eventually, if this is carried on, though, this is something that's going to come back and bite them, I think, to a certain extent, because if there's more and more cases like this, more and more people will bring attention to it, and I think eventually something has to give in this case, right?
You would think so. You would think so. I know that, for instance, the most high-profile Scottish case, the Lockerbie case, which was trumpeted as being a triumph of the Scottish judicial system. And when you used to go on at one time, 3 or 4 years ago, if you'd have went onto the Scottish court's website, it was up there as a sort of ideal case. You know, they were saying this was a triumph of Scottish justice. Now you wouldn't find it. You need to do a Google search to find it, because it's so discredited. And rather than cause them to re-examine themselves, all that appears to be happening is they seem to be closing ranks. They seem to be circling the wagons and say, we're not, fingers in our ears, we're not going to listen to any criticism. And it's very, very troubling. And yeah, I don't, when the democratic route domestically in the Scottish Parliament is cut off and is being seen to be so hopeless, just a talking shop, then you do wonder what the next step will be.
Well, exactly. And again, not to take it off topic too much, but I remember in terms of the Lockerbie case, I think it was actually one of the testifiers, I think it was Gaddafi actually, who talked about an international Masonic conspiracy in relation to Lockerbie and what actually happened there. Yeah,
that was mentioned. Well, when I put my first petition to the Scottish Parliament, I managed to get hold of a vanity publication for members of the Speculative Society of Edinburgh. And I was able to prove by reference to it listed the members who were young advocates at that time. And I checked them up with the law lords of the day, and over two thirds of the Scottish law lords at that time were members of that same all-male Edinburgh group from Edinburgh University. Hmm. Now, that is just crazy. And at the Lockerbie trial, whatever happened, McGrahy was going to be judged by a majority of members of the Speculative Society. The Lord Advocate who set the case up, Lord Fraser of Kirkmiley, was a member of the Speculative Society. McGrahy's counsel, Burns, was a member of the Speculative Society. And not only were they all members of the Speculative Society, but they were all undeclared members. So even if it were a perfectly innocent gathering, which, you know, it may be, but even if it were, why would they not declare that at the time and let McGrahy know? And I drew it to the attention of the UN observer at the trial, and he was very concerned about it and did a press release on it. Professor Cockler said that this may have interfered with justice.
Yeah.
And I believe even though it didn't, the perception is there. Even though they all belong to the same golf club, it doesn't pass the test of objective impartiality where you've got to be able to say to an independent person, look, if you knew this, would it cause doubts in your mind? Because, of course, it would.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Now, if you were to speculate a little bit here, Tom, then, if you want to, do you think that surrounding the case of Annie Börjesson, that something actually has happened? Is there a case of mistaken identity or anything else like that? We've heard, we talked briefly, I just want to mention that, we talked briefly with Guyu about the suggestion that at the very airport, actually, there is some activity that's been going on with CIA rendition planes and everything else. Any comments on that?
Well, that was certainly a live issue at the time.
At Prestwick Airport, yeah.
At Prestwick Airport, plane spotters had taken the numbers of planes that were said to be CIA planes doing rendition flights. Questions were raised in Parliament, and, you know, journalists wanted the police to look into it, but nothing ever came of it. I don't know that was a link. The fact that this Christina Borges and the American journalist name got brought into it certainly raised a few eyebrows, but
yeah.
Christina Borges said she wasn't investigating Prestwick, although that doesn't take the coincidence away entirely.
No, it doesn't.
But,
but she was, though, I believe, because I remember Googling her name a little bit, and she was... She's most known for looking into the TWA flight 800.
Yeah. 800.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think there was a related issue there, because there was something she was looking into, a news story where this particular case was involved about the rendition planes going out of Prestwick, you know? So.
Well, I don't know about that, but if she was, then it would be a bigger coincidence. But, you know, just the name alone is certainly, you know, somebody who is the nemesis of the CIA because of the 800 incident, somebody with the same name dying at Prestwick,
yeah.
It would certainly raise eyebrows. But I've never really gone into that side of it. I've always concentrated on practical help.
And that's it,
you know. Anything I could do to help, really, because I feel ashamed of the way our government's treated it.
Yeah, I understand that. Now, what would you like to see happen within Scotland for this type of things to change and begin to move in a better direction, Tom?
Well, I would like this petition that's with the Parliament at the minute to be heeded and at least give us the same as they have in England, where you have coroner, as an independent coroner, looking at causes of death, not an assumption, an automatic assumption, without investigation of suicide. That's got to be investigated the same as a murder, as is in England. And the loved ones, the grieving ones that are left behind, have got to have access to the information. They can't be like Guye Borgeson sitting in Kilmarnock Police Station and having a sit down until they let her see information that she is entitled to have.
Yeah.
The police files on her daughter are every bit as much hers as they are the police's, more so. And they should be, the grieving ones should be able to see that. So I'd like to see the petition at Parliament succeed. I don't have high hopes of that, though, and I keep in touch backwards and forwards with Stuart Graham, who I've met once. He's a genuine man. I've watched his presentation to the Parliament. He's had a senior English police detective inspector who'd done so many criminal or investigations, you know, speaking on his behalf as well. He had a terrific presentation. Sadly, the Parliament often just turn a deaf ear to that and just say no further action. They think everything's fine the way it is. And yeah, something's got to snap somewhere, because it can't keep going like this.
Well, exactly, then. That's right. Well, it certainly is a bizarre case, and I hope that more information will be coming out, and so that Guye can obviously resolve the situation and get some answers in this, because we wouldn't want to see this go on for years and years, but I fear that it might, and I hope, if so, that more and more attention is brought to this, so that, you know, there's more pressure on Scotland, even internationally, then, so that, you know, people within Scotland can begin to change the system as well, you know?
Yes, well, it's certainly, there are plenty of people in Scotland who are dissatisfied, and no shortage of very, very bizarre cases that have been classed as suicide. So it certainly risks Scotland being labelled not as a world leader, but as a basket case for justice.
Yeah, very good. Now, Tom, please let us know if there's anything else that we've kind of left out that you think is important. Otherwise, for Scottish listeners who want to follow you, considering the work that you're doing with your petitions and whatnot, let us know as well if you want to give out your Twitter or any other website where people can follow, you know, the work that you're doing.
Well, I'm at, let me see, what's my Twitter handle, is at Minogue Tom. That's MinogueTom. That's my Twitter. And that's probably the best way. And I put links up to my websites from there, and deal with various subjects that, you know, ranging from the Elgin Marbles. I don't have one on Guye's or Annie Borgeson on its own, but there are quite a few websites in Scotland carry that. But on general justice issues, the Twitter would be the best, I suppose.
All right, very good. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Tom, for adding your addition to this.
You're welcome, and take care, Henrik. Do your best for Guye, because she deserves better than she's had.
Absolutely.
Cheers now.
Okay, that begins to round things up for this time. Then, it's always great having you with us. Thank you for listening today. We hope that more information will come to the family soon, that there will be more known, so that this case can be resolved and that the corruption will be exposed in the process. We have upcoming here on the program Sophia Smallstorm, Mark Weber, Judy Verith Baker, Patrick Henningsen, and Stephen McNallan, to name a few. Please sign up for a membership at redicemembers.com and get full access to our archives and support our efforts. Help us grow and expand as we come to you without commercial interruptions and ad-free websites. If you like what we do, subscribe and catch the entire program. And you can also see our videos, films, and listen to our commentaries and much more such upcoming adventures. Have a great day or evening wherever you are, and we will talk more soon. Take care.